today on Against the Grain.
Core in particular said we've got to take the sit-in and we have to apply that to police violence. We have to literally have sit-ins inside police stations, or we have to have pickets outside the stations, or we have to hold a protest in front of a commissioner's home, or we have to hold protests in front of City Hall, or have sit-ins inside City Hall against police violence, against physical violence.
Conventional wisdom holds that the civil rights movement of the 1950s and early 60s neglected the question of police violence, only to be remedied by the Black Panther Party and decades later by the movement for Black Lives. But historian Joshua Clark Davis argues that that assumption is inaccurate. He also discusses the extensive involvement of local police departments, above and beyond the FBI's COINTELPRO, in disrupting and repressing the civil rights movement. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The FBI's campaign to infiltrate, surveil, and destroy the civil rights movement is well known. But as Joshua Clark Davis writes in his new book, much less is known about the widespread repressive efforts of local police departments and their red squads. In Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back, Davis illustrates the long history of radical activists organizing against police repression. He's Associate Professor of History at the University of Baltimore. Police violence was a key concern of the Black Panther Party, but the earlier civil rights movement has a reputation for not opposing it. Josh, how accurate is that?
Well, it's not really accurate at all that it didn't look at police violence. I think you're right that that's the prevailing view of a difference, a key difference between the civil rights movement and, say, the Black Panther Party later in the 1960s. But what I found in researching for this book, Police Against the Movement, was that there was a large portion of the civil rights movement that was very concerned about police violence, that was concerned with protesting it and organizing against it and resisting it, as opposed to just enduring it and suffering through it, like we might be led to believe by those very widely circulated iconic images from, say, Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, where the police are attacking protesters with fire hoses and attack dogs, or Selma, Alabama, 1965, where protesters are just brutalized at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We have not really built into our larger narrative of the civil rights movement the idea that the movement didn't just experience police violence, but that it also fought it.
So when we think about violence and repression against the civil rights movement in the 1960s, we tend to think about COINTELPRO, the program of surveillance by the FBI, of surveillance, infiltration, disruption, and more. And that was focused on the movements for racial justice, but on the left more broadly. But you're right that local police played a crucial role even before the full-fledged advent of COINTELPRO against the civil rights movement. Broadly speaking, what form did such repression take place emanating from local police?
So a lot of what I was trying to do in Police Against the Movement was exactly what you just said, and basically make the argument that we have really obsessed over things like COINTELPRO and J. Edgar Hoover at the expense of understanding how state repression was very widespread against the civil rights movement on the local level, and particularly how it was local police departments all over the country, north, south, east, and west, who were surveilling civil rights organizers, infiltrating their groups, bringing attacks on them that were legal, technological, reputational, and that it was within police departments really what were called red squads. They were basically secretive political intelligence units that existed in almost every major police department across the country by the mid-1960s. Many of them had dated back to the 20s, and even the Red Squads in Chicago and New York predated the FBI. So that's really at the center of this book, basically saying, yes, COINTELPRO was important, and yes, what Hoover and the FBI did was devastating in many ways, but we have really ignored how local law enforcement agencies were doing much of this work, often doing it before COINTELPRO, at least the COINTELPRO that was declared against so-called black extremists in 1967, and how red squads were doing things in some ways that were even more extreme and more disruptive and dangerous than what the FBI was willing to do.
Well, what the arguments that you make in Police Against the Movement indicate is that to really understand the kind of political repression that the civil rights movement experienced, we actually have to take kind of a longer view and widen our lens as well in terms of looking at the history of repression of the left. You mentioned the Red Squads, and I wonder if you could tell us more about them, how they were formed, and how they operated.
Yeah, excellent question. I mean, one of the things I'll say before answering directly is that a major innovation in the study and understanding of the civil rights movement in the last 3 decades has been this concept of the long civil rights movement. And that notion was really popularized by the historian Jacqueline Dowd Hall, and it's basically the idea that we can't understand the civil rights movement by looking at just, the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955 until the assassination of Dr. King in 1968. Some people might call that the Montgomery to Memphis narrative, and the long civil rights movement thesis argues actually we have to look probably as far back as the 30s at least to develop a working understanding of the civil rights movement that is accurate. And we also have to look at what came after the 60s. So we have not really applied that thesis yet to state repression and to law enforcement. Again, this is something that the COINTELPRO obsession really does, is that it really tightly narrows our attention on a few years in the late 1960s, and it cuts out not only what the FBI was doing before then, but it cuts out the Red Squads. So you were asking about the Red Squad's history. Like I was mentioning, the earliest ones were founded by the NYPD and the Chicago PD, I think, in the very early years of the 20th century. I think the big boom, however, first came in the 20s, following World War I and following, the Palmer raids and the 1919 crackdown on radicals. And so, yes, in many ways, local law enforcement were taking cues from federal agents, federal officials. But I think what you see by the 30s is that there is a Red Squad in every major city police department, and they are operating pretty much independently of federal officials. They might collaborate from time to time, but they have their own agendas, they have their own undercover operations, they have their own surveillance operations, they have their own intelligence operations. And yeah, of course, they're called Red Squads because they mostly go after communists. And so they really experience a major expansion in the 30s and 40s. But the thing is, in the Red Scare of the late 40s and 50s, the Communist Party is basically brought to its knees and almost totally destroyed in the United States. And so what was interesting by the start of the 1960s is Red Squads maybe didn't have as much to do as they wished they did. There weren't many communists around. There were some, but nowhere near as many as there had been in the 30s and 40s. And part of what I suggest is in this book is that the civil rights movement, in a sense, gave these Red Squads a new reason to live. And not only did it re-energize some of those Red Squads who redevoted themselves to surveillance and disruption, but it also, in some instances, gave rise to new Red Squads, cities where they hadn't had Red Squads, or maybe cities where, for example, the Red Squad had basically been almost disbanded since the late 40s or early 50s, just because they did not have as much work to do as they thought they had once had.
Well, just so we can keep that longer sweep of history in mind and think about the sort of continuities, Can you give us examples of how the Red Squads operated in their heyday as Red Squads?
Yes, so I would say, for example, if we're looking at the 1960s, the most important Red Squad was the one in New York City, the Bureau of Special Services, and I don't think that Red Squad, that unit, was ever disbanded, but it was renamed over the decades, and so it sometimes is hard to trace. But I think what they did was they did the kind of things that we associate with the FBI. In fact, we might think of the Red Squads as little FBIs. So they collected intelligence. They basically read lots of press, especially activist press and, left-wing press. They did lots of, clippings. They attended rallies. They attended speeches. They took notes of what was happening at those rallies and speeches. They took notes about attendees. They looked at license plates. Sometimes they went to smaller meetings. I think what really picked up in the mid-60s in response to the civil rights movement in New York and a number of other cities is that these units began to go even beyond that and began to do the work of disruption. So in New York, the Bureau of Special Services in 1964 started sending undercover officers into civil rights groups, for example, the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, and had officers on the payroll masquerading as activists, as political organizers. And this might seem like a fine distinction to some people, but almost always the FBI, when it was infiltrating organizations, it hired an outside contractor to do that, so to speak, an informant. And it was the same dirty work, but Hoover and the FBI were very afraid about the possibility of an FBI agent being caught and identified inside the Communist Party or inside a civil rights group. They really preferred to outsource it. So, in the case that someone was caught, they could disassociate and disavow them and say, oh, we have nothing to do with them. The NYPD, however, the LAPD, the Houston Police Department, I believe the Chicago Police Department, we could name others, where they sent active duty police officers into these political organizations with no compunction about whether they were on the public payroll or not. And so, in places like New York and Chicago, I believe, also a number of places, these undercover officers often tried to coax activists into doing very reckless schemes, things that would hurt their own activities, things that would land people in jail or in mental institutions or in prison, and things that would basically undermine the political program of an organization.
Well, how effective were the Red Squads in their infiltration efforts? You just noted that they had paid employees, in effect, going in to organizations where presumably they looked quite different in all sorts of ways than the activists.
I think one way that police departments and Red Squads were different from the FBI was in the racial composition of their officers. I mean, police departments in big cities were still overwhelmingly white. However, in places like New York, LA, Detroit, Chicago, a number of these departments, you had officers who by that time were, the officer ranks were 5% African American or 10% African American, some Latino officers as well. By contrast, the FBI in the late 1960s was not even 1% black. So, in these big city police departments, they are hiring police officers who do look like many civil rights activists, who are willing to infiltrate organizations and to draw less attention, one, because of their race, two, perhaps because of their age and their background, and I think three, because what many of these Red Squads did, if they infiltrated groups, is they really prized a police officer who had not undergone cadet training or who had not worked for very long and on the force. Basically, police officers who not only were unknown in their communities, but also ones who maybe had not yet really kind of adopted the thinking and look and comportment of the police department. So that's how they did get into some of these organizations without being detected. And that's how they did manage to land some organizers not only in jail, but in prison. And, it's hard to measure how effective they were, but I think if the idea is to disrupt political organizers' activities, we can point to a number of examples in different cities where they did that, and that was how they measured success.
I'm speaking with historian Joshua Clark Davis about his book, Police Against the Movement: The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. When you talk about the efforts by the Red Squads, these local police targeting the civil rights movement in the 60s, clearly the civil rights movement had its range of organizations, some more liberal than others. Did these squads target some organizations more over others, or was it pretty much the same?
That's a good question. I think in general, they tended to target more radical civil rights organizers. Part of what I'm trying to do in policing the movement is, again, bring the radical wing of the movement back into the story. And that's not only the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, but it's also the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE. And I really focus on those two organizations in particular, because they were much more assertive in challenging police violence and protesting it and in resisting all kinds of police violence. I don't just mean physical violence, I mean also challenging things like surveillance when they discovered it, or challenging felony indictments of organizers. They were the ones leading that battle, and especially it was CORE at first, in a way that we don't think of CORE as much today as we used to. But I think what's important in terms of your question is that I found case after case after case in researching this book where Red Squads targeted organizers who were protesting police violence and police brutality, and that there was this retaliatory dynamic there where, to give one example, Michael Schorner, who, sadly is known as one of the three civil rights activists who were killed in Philadelphia, Mississippi, in 1964 in Freedom Summer. And one of the things that was very eye-opening to me was to learn that before he had gone to Mississippi, he had been a CORE organizer in New York City, and CORE was probably the leading organization against police violence. And their chapters in New York were probably the most active in that organization. And so he was protesting police brutality in the fall of 1963, long before he had been killed, or not long, but months before. And I found surveillance files from protests where he's protesting police violence, and where he and also Rita Schorner were identified by the NYPD Red Squad. Fast forward 8 months when Michael Schorner is killed in Mississippi by a number of people affiliated with the Klan. At least one of the people who conspired to kill him was a local police officer. Lawrence Rainey, I believe, was the name, and he ended up being convicted in federal court for civil rights violations. There's no connection, of course, between what the NYPD was doing when it was surveilling someone like Michael Schorner, and when the police officer in Mississippi helped to kill him. There's no direct link there. But for me, that was a very sad and telling trajectory, where it was this activist who had joined the effort against police violence, been the subject of police surveillance, and that was in his hometown of New York City. And then he goes to another part of the country where a police officer actively assists in his murder. And so I think any activist who was challenging police violence was often a likely target of police surveillance.
How did the organizing against police violence that you write about with SNCC and CORE compare to the work of organizations like the NAACP and Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference? Did they take up this issue of political repression in the same way?
No, they did not. And I think this was a major difference in the movement that I tried to delineate, in the sense that SNCC and CORE really took on this issue of political repression, especially SNCC by the late 60s. All four of the organizations you just mentioned, CORE, SNCC, the SCLC, and the NAACP, all of them, of course, were opposed to police violence. All of them were, very much opposed to police using physical violence against activists, against people in general, particularly communities of color. But for the NAACP, their main engagement with that issue was in, I guess, periodically bringing federal civil rights cases in some of the most egregious instances against police departments. They were doing that a bit in the 50s and 60s, but they were not interested in direct political action against police violence. They were not really interested in street protests. They were not really interested in confronting state repression, for example, in the forms of surveillance, not as a main political program. SCLC, pretty similar story. I think what's a little complicated there is Dr. King and his allies clearly understood the value of physical violence in terms of attracting media attention. And it's not that they thought it was good when activists were attacked, but we have documented cases, we have evidence that suggests, they're very keenly aware of the fact that if a police force like Birmingham, led by Bull Connor, attacks protesters, then that's going to grab national headlines. And that, in a way, is going to, provide some political momentum to the movement. Those attacks on black children in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, the fire hoses and the attack dogs, that was the George Floyd m moment of the civil rights movement. And it really drew massive national and international headlines. And so the SCLC was interested in that. And however, they were not really interested in making organizing against political repression a central part of their political activities. And so that makes the SCLC and NAACP pretty different from SNCC and CORE in that regard. They certainly acknowledged police violence as a major problem, but it was not, one of the top five major problems they set about combating through organizing.
Do those differences represent more than just sort of strategic considerations, like this idea of, spectacular moments where the media may appear and photograph people being bludgeoned, and then the idea that that might sway the opinion of people in the broader US public versus a kind of political analysis around the role of the police and police repression? Does this sort of distinction or difference that you've just been laying out reflect real sort of ideological differences, different understandings about the role of police repression in the society at large?
Yes, I think it does. I think what I tried to highlight in Police Against the Movement was that the main voices and the main organizers in the civil rights movement who really thought that the movement should be organizing against police violence, most of them were not communists or socialists, but they were people who were open to talking with them. They were people who maybe had friends or linkages to communists and socialists, and I would say people who were not terrified of those linkages being public. SNCC, I would really say, kind of had a come as you are policy. I mean, they were a non-sectarian leftist group, but they didn't, they almost had a kind of don't ask, don't tell approach to Marxists and communists. I think CORE was an organization that was rooted in a very kind of particular Christian socialism of the 40s. That's kind of someone like Bayard Rustin's background. And so those, the Communist Party long before almost any other formation was talking about political repression and talking about things like state surveillance as major forms of oppression to fight, going back to the 30s, if not earlier, at least in the US. And so they were in many ways leading the charge against police violence in the 30s and 40s. I think on the other hand, what happened in the early 50s is there were instances where like NAACP activists tried to lead street campaigns against police violence. I write about Ella Baker in the book trying to do that in New York City. And basically, she just faces a tsunami of accusations from the NYPD of being a communist. And basically, in those early Red Scare years, fighting police violence was made radioactive in the sense that police and other officials condemned people who protested police brutality basically as communist dupes or maybe even secret subversives. And basically, they said, well, you're questioning one of the core functions of American democracy and government, therefore, you are trying to destroy our government. And the NAACP was famously the most anti-communist of the civil rights organizations. They were very famously anti-communist. They purged communists, suspected communists, and they actively curried favor in some instances with the FBI over that. I think that was. Hearing this recently about how NAACP leadership solicited commendation letters from J. Edgar Hoover, basically, for their anti-communist efforts. SCLC was similarly anti-communist. They were friends with some communists, but the FBI, as it put more and more pressure on the SCLC over time, basically made it very dangerous for people like King to associate with communists like Jack O'Dell or people like Stanley Levinson, former communists. So in short, it kind of broke down on those lines. Organizations that were comfortable at least being in conversation with Marxists were often the ones fighting police violence, and the organizations that were much more nervous about that or even explicitly anti-communist were much less interested in street organizing, direct action against political violence and against police repression.
How did groups like CORE that were taking on this issue of police repression organize around more than just physical violence? How did they organize against political policing, this broader repression, infiltration, and so on?
Right. So I think we can agree that all policing to some degree is political, but I use this term political policing in the book, and I didn't invent that term, but it is basically describing police work that explicitly targets political organizers. And one of the things that CORE did that was basically kind of established it as the vanguard in the civil rights movement against police violence was that in the wake of those awful Birmingham police attacks on protesters in the spring of 1963, CORE was the first civil rights organization that said nationally to all its chapters, let's focus on fighting police violence. If you hear about instances of police brutality, CORE organizers should learn what happened and they should have protests and they should go to police stations and they should hold sit-ins and they should demand meetings with police commissioners. But CORE pushed it a step further. They had an individual named Alan Gartner in their leadership who wrote a study of police violence in, I think, late 63. And basically, he argued, and he was kind of trying to write this document for the organization, he argued that we should talk less about police violence and more about police malpractice. And he said what we need to do is not just focus on physical attacks on protesters and physical attacks on people of color, but we have to also look at false arrests. We have to look at forced confessions. We have to look at false imprisonments. We have to look at trumped up felony indictments that end up resulting in no convictions because they never had the evidence in the first place, but in the process kind of really hurt people's lives. And so that concept of police malpractice was a really interesting one to me because it was a thinker in a civil rights movement group saying, hey, this is much bigger than physical violence. And I think that's another kind of difference, going back to your previous question. The SCLC and NAACP, their conception of police violence was overwhelmingly a physical one, whereas CORE and SCNC were thinking much more broadly about different types of political violence, state repression, and kind of basically witnessing a repeat of the Red Scare as it was playing out against civil rights activists and, basically trying to fight that.
I'm speaking with the author of Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle and the Activists Who Fought Back. Historian Joshua Clark Davis is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So can you tell us about the forms of activism that groups like CORE and SCNC used in their organizing, bearing in mind what you've said, that they had a different framework for understanding the police. So, with that broader framework of repression, not just moments of physical violence, how did they organize? What sorts of campaigns or tactics or strategies did they use?
Well, in terms of physical violence, I mean, I think one thing that distinguished them from SCLC and from the NAACP was that CORE in particular said, we've got to take the sit-in and we have to apply that to police violence. We have to literally have sit-ins inside police stations, or we have to have pickets outside the stations, or we have to hold a protest in front of a commissioner's home, or we have to hold protests in front of City Hall or have sit-ins inside City Hall for against police violence, against physical violence. And so that was one part of their program. But I think going beyond physical violence, what really becomes, I think, important in the mid and late 60s is the defense campaigns, basically. And I think we sometimes misconceived of political defense campaigns as just defensive work, just merely reactive. What happens to SCNC, for example, is there are dozens of SCNC organizers across the country who are hit with felony indictments from roughly 63 to 68. And it's for, a variety of charges. It's usually something like state insurrection charges. Some of these insurrection laws literally date back to the years of slavery. And this happens in a number of places. It happens in Danville, Virginia. It happens in Nashville, Tennessee. It happens in Houston, where basically SCNC organizers are accused of trying to foment riots or create civil disturbances. They're not just being put in jail for a night or two, they are being charged with felonies that carry prison time. And in many of these cases, SCNC organizes defense campaigns to defend those individuals. And I think one thing that's important is they aren't just campaigns to provide legal defense, but they are campaigns for political education. And they are campaigns that often try to bring attention to and to fight these larger police attacks on the movement. Right? Not just to say, hey, it's just these four SCNC organizers in Houston who have been falsely charged with killing a police officer, but instead taking a local campaign, maybe connecting with some other organizations, and then trying to turn it into a national campaign to raise political awareness. And I think that defense work, that political defense work, really is an under-acknowledged form of late 1960s civil rights activism. It looks very different than the organizing that SCNC is famous for registering voters, for going into rural counties in Alabama and Mississippi, to desegregating interstate buses with the Freedom Rides, as CORE also did. And I think we've kind of left that kind of defense work out of our conception of what civil rights activism could look like. And it's often dismissed as, oh, that's not really organizing. And that was something I argued against in this book and said, no, this is still political work against police violence. That's important.
Well, the prevailing view of the civil rights movement is often mainly focused on struggles in the South. You know, that the civil rights movement was mainly a movement in the South. How did groups like CORE and SNCC organize against police repression in places like the West Coast and elsewhere?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I mean, this is at the heart of my book. Another one of the major innovations by historians of the civil rights movement in the last 20 years or so has been to basically shatter the myth that the civil rights movement was strictly Southern. Discrimination, racism, white supremacy were national problems, American problems, and the movement to fight them was a national movement. That's not how we typically tell the story of that history, but the Northern civil rights movement has become a bigger and bigger part of kind of the scholarly understanding, and so there's a continued effort to bring that attention to the Northern movement and the Western movement to the public. And that was something I didn't talk a lot about in my book as much as I just did it, in the sense that I write about Birmingham, Alabama, I write about Danville, Virginia, I write about Nashville, Tennessee, yes, but I write extensively about New York City, about LA, I write about Seattle, I write about Philadelphia. One thing that was really fascinating to me that you referred to in the question was, I think we all know that the Black Panther Party impressively, brilliantly came up with a plan to challenge police brutality in places like Oakland by deploying police patrols, basically sending guys out, usually who were armed in self-defense, to watch what police were doing on the streets of Oakland and San Francisco and other cities. And that was one of the ways that the Panthers became famous. What I learned in my research, and this has been documented in a few places, but it never really, in kind of scattered ways, but basically, organizers from CORE in Seattle, for example, were doing police patrols, patrolling the streets for police brutality at least a year before the Black Panther Party was founded. There was a similar organization in LA called the Community Alert Patrol that was doing something, even with patrol cars. There were some efforts, I think, in Oakland as well. And all three of these efforts precede the Panthers. This is in no way to kind of minimize like the importance of the Panthers' work. I think rather what I really wanted to show is that if we look very carefully, we sometimes think, some would say, oh, the Black Panther Party, like they just totally rejected the civil rights movement's approach to political organizing. You know, they rejected the nonviolent suffering and kumbaya and basically took a totally different approach. And what I have identified in this book in a number of ways is that there's actually some really important ways that the organizing that SNCC and CORE did against police violence that really influenced the Panthers. Not just preceded it, but we can find linkages where, oh, the Panthers knew about the Community Alert Patrol because they read the movement newspaper published by the Friends of SNCC in San Francisco. Or the Panthers knew about the Deacons for Defense in Louisiana because they met them. And the Deacons for Defense were a group affiliated with CORE doing, you know, armed police patrols in Louisiana at least a year or two before the Panthers emerged. So that was very important to me. And yeah, there was a lot of activity on the West Coast. Really, it was Seattle, Bay Area, and LA where these police patrols go back to at least mid-65, and the Panthers aren't founded until October of 66.
Well, beyond the Black Panthers, what do you think is the legacy of these efforts of civil rights organizations like SNCC and CORE in responding to police repression, shaping a politics and an activism around challenging the police? I mean, at the beginning of the program, you spoke about how much of this history seems to be lost to us now, or at least the continuities are much less obvious. But taking the view that you have, can you see the influence of that kind of organizing on subsequent movements?
Yes, and I think this is really part of the genesis of this book. I started writing it in 2017, and at the time, the Black Lives Matter movement was really on the rise, was getting a lot of media attention, and lots of media were describing BLM as picking up where the civil rights movement ended, or finally getting around to the work that the civil rights movement wasn't able to address, or handling the unfinished work of the movement. That's not how BLM organizers were talking, but that was a very common narrative in the media. And I started just to wonder, well, okay, what did the civil rights movement actually do about police violence? Because I didn't know much, I didn't see much in the literature, plenty about the police violence the civil rights movement endured, but not about what it did about it. And so that to me is really, that was the kind of founding question of the book. And it took me on this, research trip basically that revealed just a tremendous amount of underacknowledged, forgotten, unacknowledged organizing by the civil rights movement against police violence. And I think, some of the good reporting on BLM would sometimes kind of trace it back to the Panthers, and that is 100% true. But I think that reporting often stopped there and didn't dig further back. And I think that's where, if you start connecting more of the dots, even going further back than the Panthers, you see, okay, police patrols and organizing campaigns against political repression and political defense campaigns that came out of the civil rights movement that shaped the Panthers. And if you dig back even further, you see socialist and especially communist campaigns against political violence that were often conjoined with civil rights campaigns in the 40s and the 30s. And so there's this much longer historical arc of political organizing against police violence than we have often acknowledged. And there are continuities there. They're not just these breaks. And so I really try to, trace out that long arc from the 30s all the way till today. And yes, how it waxed and waned, and how sometimes for many decades there really wasn't a discernible national movement against police violence. There certainly was during BLM, there certainly was during the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, but in some ways became many more scattered local movements at different points in the 70s and 80s. But the organizing didn't go away. And I think that was, for me, what was important, the legacy of the civil rights movement's attack on police violence that we just have not really acknowledged in any meaningful way, and to show that they were planting the seeds in many ways of BLM without necessarily being credited for it, and not just in a general sense, in a movement for racial equality, but in a very specific sense, in a movement that, in some parts of that movement, centered the fight against police violence as part of the work of creating and fostering racial equality and fighting racial injustice.
Joshua Clark Davis, why do you think that is? Why has there been that perception of rupture between the movements of the 60s and now? Why is that history kind of missing?
I think a big part of the problem is that the dominant narrative and public memory of the civil rights movement is still fairly sanitized. It's still one that really emphasizes Dr. King, and one that really emphasizes the early 60s, the March on Washington. Yes, the work of SNCC is still like fairly well known, but it's like, in many cases, the work of SNCC is kind of reduced to someone like John Lewis. And that's not a critique of King or Lewis, but it's to say that the way most people in our society remember the civil rights movement is a very narrow view. It's a very narrow view of a few major personalities. And even when we broaden that view, it still is one that, in many ways, downplays the radical nature of the civil rights movement, I think. And things have gotten better in how people talk about and remember these things, I think, in recent decades. But I think still, even the way we remember the civil rights movement and its radical years, I think especially kind of the mid and late 60s, those years are much less remembered than the early 60s. And so a sense when we're talking about, after the Voting Rights Act is passed, after the Civil Rights Act is passed, pretty quickly the narrative jumps to the Panthers, who were doing, really impressive work. But what that narrative sometimes does is it kind of acts like CORE and SNCC just disappeared. And those are some of those organizations' most radical years, kind of 65, 66, 67.
Well, in Police Against the Movement, you write about two histories that haven't been transmitted to the present adequately. So one side is just what you said, that this more radical part of the civil rights movement being underemphasized, underunderstood, and crucial dimensions like the struggle around police repression and police violence, therefore not being remembered in these histories. But you also say that another part of the record of that time that's missing has to do with what evidence remains of the Red Squads and the political repression, these local police units, that if we just focus on COINTELPRO, we're actually missing a lot of the story. So why is that part of this history also not really known?
Well, kind of along the lines of us over-relying on Dr. King to tell the story of the civil rights movement, even though there have been some pretty big improvements in that area in the last few decades, the dominant way of telling the story of state repression and the civil rights movement is still clinging to this narrative of Hoover versus King. And, the FBI and Hoover did terrible political damage to King. And it's a fascinating story. It's a very ugly story. There's really big personalities in it. But if we're trying to move away from the so-called great man history, we should do the same thing when we're telling the history of political repression of the movement and not just the movement itself. But, one of the things that happened in the 1970s is that political organizers started identifying what the Red Squads were doing in a concrete way. A lot of these Red Squads started, filing felony indictments against political organizers, including the Panthers, in the late 60s and 70s, like the Panther 21 trial in New York. And in the process of bringing these charges, the police began to share some of these surveillance documents publicly. And activists really seized upon them as evidence of unconstitutional actions by these Red Squads. And in this happened in cities all over the country where activists in the early 70s, and they were a coalition of like civil rights activists, Black Power activists, Panthers, anti-war activists, some pretty big coalitions began to confront police departments in places like New York, Houston, Memphis, Detroit, Chicago, and in many cases they started filing federal suits against these departments for violations of First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, so on and so forth. And what happened in many different cities is that police officials destroyed thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases even millions of records from these Red Squads. Much of the evidence has been destroyed. Fortunately, in a few cities, the files have been preserved, at least partially. New York's one of them, Houston's one of them, Chicago, although they are very difficult to write about and cite because of the restrictions of the court settlement. And, I think what we have today, in addition to those missing documents, is we have police departments all over the country who fall over themselves on Martin Luther King's birthday to wish him a happy birthday. Or when it's Juneteenth, they are posting things on social media to say that they are celebrating the holiday. And that's the story that police want to tell, of course. And the story of COINTELPRO, FBI, Hoover is very famous, but the story of police repression of the movements on a local level remains very little known, and police want it to stay that way.
We're living through a period of intensified political repression, and I wanted to ask you if you think there are any lessons for opposing political repression that we could glean from the struggles of the civil rights movement.
Yes, there are a few. I mean, organizers right now are beyond busy trying to mount campaigns and efforts against ICE, for example, or to, defend people who are in danger of being ripped from their homes and put in detention centers. These efforts, of course, are also combined with efforts to protect people who, for example, are involved in movements for Palestinian solidarity, for example, right? There's kind of been this overlap we've seen where some of those organizers have been targeted. So, what can organizers do in addition to that when they're already so busy and so stretched thin? I think one thing that I saw in my research was just like the importance of political organizers doing their own research and, having a person or two who has the time and the bandwidth to try to really learn the ins and outs of public records laws and to learn what journalists do to wrest records that are secret out of the hands of police departments where it's possible. I think that this kind of task of documentation is so important if movements are able to protect themselves at all against surveillance and state repression and infiltration. They have to be able to document it. What we're seeing now, what people are doing, all these folks who are documenting what ICE is doing, the people who are going out in their neighborhoods, they are trailing ICE, they are sharing pictures online, they are trying to identify people, they are trying to document and potentially even disrupt these illegal arrests and seizures of people. That in many ways draws on the work of police patrols, not only from the Panthers, but from the civil rights movement.
Josh Davis, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Joshua Clark Davis. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of Baltimore, author of Police Against the Movement, The Sabotage of the Civil Rights Struggle, and The Activists Who Fought Back. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.